Do you want to make your money make sense? Listen to Business Sense every Monday to Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and make sense of your money.
As mentioned, today is Shapeshifter Thursday, and on Thursdays we speak to shapeshifters. And my guest this evening, it is of course Usanda Zungu, now born in Nduzuma, Durban, to an SDA family, right, making him a third generation Seventh Day Adventist. That's who he is, and where he was born. Studied an undergrad in Natal Technikon, and also became an alumni of Stellenbosch University with a master's degree in maritime studies. He also, of course, was supposed to be a sailor, but studied to be a navigating officer. But, of course, God had other plans as well. Currently, he's an executive in charge of supply chain and logistics for a copper mine and is the CEO of Maibute Managed Logistics. So basically, his journey is on supply chain, primarily from mine to market. He loves people. That's what he says, and enjoys traveling into Africa, and together with some quote-unquote crazy people like him, they are venturing to Cairo this year in a 45-year-old convoy from Cape Town. That's why it's called Cape to Cairo, and they have done a few tours already as part of the training for this 12,000 kilometers, the most recent being 8,000 round trip to Angola via Botswana and Namibia. The difference between 12 and 8 is just a couple, ne? Now, if they did a round trip of 8, I'm sure they can do 12,000 there. So that's what they've done recently. And they've received some great welcome from Luanda Central SDA Church and the Hope Channel as well. Now, the trips started as a few guys who were just excited about showcasing Africa to the rest of the world. But this is now changing to be a ministry which is made up of love for one another and love to self. And he's joining me on the line as we speak to him. My good sir, good evening.
Good evening, Tabello. Good morning to the listeners.
Yeah, how are you today?
Excellent.
What a bio. I think it's one of those things that when you hear them being read, you're like, is that me?
Yeah, it's I'd like to think I'm not that guy, but suppose it's what it is, right? It's like your birth certificate.
Modesty is a good thing, though. But yes, definitely, that's you right there. I mean, that makes you a shapeshifter. So that's why we appreciate people like you joining us on this particular one. I mean, I think you've done really great already, and this conversation is really one that I was looking forward to, because what a job and what a journey you've already traveled up until so far. So we just want to first say thank you so much for joining us and giving us your time.
No, thank you. Thank you, Tapela. Really, really appreciate it. And I think this is home for me.
Yes.
My church.
Yes.
My community, my people, my brothers and sisters. So it really hits home in many, many ways. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you so much, my good sir. I want to take you back then. Let's go back to Nduzuma. What was that like? Let's go back there.
You know, they say home is where the heart is.
Yes, right?
And for those who don't know, Nduzuma, and even now it's popular for the wrong reasons, but Nduzuma is by extension a township that developed from Kwamashu.
Okay.
So, that's it's kind of like nestled between Kwamashu and Inanda.
Okay.
Inanda is quite famous for many other things.
Yes.
So born and bred in Nduzuma, I think when we started early on, before we even formed the church, we used to go Kwamashu, then it became a company. You know how it goes? And then we formed the main church. And so my home church is in Nduzuma, South Seventh Day Adventist Church back in Durban. You know, and born in the 70s, right?
Yes.
Late 70s.
Yes.
Born in the late 70s. The dusty streets of Nduzuma, our location was starting up at the time. The extension of the location. But, you know, I grew up in a beautiful big family. My grandmother, she went to Bethel College back in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Beautiful story. You know, my mother tells me today.
Yeah.
Then we've got to visit the institution. My dad, from his family, they accepted the gospel back in the early 60s. So from both families, we grew up. There's nothing else that we knew than the three angels' message.
Mm.
In many ways, I want to say this, though.
Mm.
In many ways, the upbringing of from the teachings from, you know, back in the days was missionary volunteers to AY. That bringing really, while our brothers and sisters went to Kanwele, some went to Bethel College and so on and so forth. So we didn't get that opportunity because of cost and what not. But the teachings, the love, the message from the parents, it's what shielded us in the early 80s. And you remember, Durban was burning at the time. And 90s came with the challenges of HIV/AIDS, getting into the new government. So in many ways, the upbringing of the of Adventism protected us in many ways. And so what am I? I think I'm a product, by far and large, of an Adventist community, though planted in a location like most of us.
Yeah.
But somehow there was a cloud and there was a, some, you know, a lead over us that saved us from the challenges. We saw it every day when we went to school.
Yeah.
But somehow I can tell you now, Tapel, where we live, I mean, we've been there for about 40 odd years. And never had a break-in, and I can't explain it. Never had a break-in for over 43, 44 years. And so I look at that, and I say, but why? And these are so many nuggets of God's providence and understanding that my parents not having an education at that time and how they were able to raise us and how our story, and this is the beautiful one before you come into it. How our story, and I can tell you, myself, my sister is a physician, specialist. My brother's an engineer. My sister got a scholarship to the U.S., my other sister. And I did whatever I did. None of us, and let me tell you, none of us, my parents didn't pay a dime for our education. And so, for me, that tells me that we cannot rely on our own faculties to get ahead in life. It's all grace and it's God at work. And look at my mom today. She had nothing, man. And and how, when I finished school, I had a scholarship. And I was not an A student, I can tell you that. I'm kind of like a CD student. And now imagine a D student getting a scholarship. How does that work? It's grace, you know, and so our story is my family's story, not mine. But my family is a beautiful story that I always share with people, and I'm grateful for that opportunity.
Let's just end it here, Wena Sanda, because that on its own is really, really quite encouraging and comforting. And it just, I suppose, you know, grandstands the bigness of God, if there's such a word, and just how big God is, and he's able to control things. Because, I mean, honestly speaking, this is a setup in the 70s, 80s that was not politically conducive for black people. Right. So that's the one bit. So you're fighting against that, you're fighting against the system. So there's always those things that some people might say, well, because they were outside of our control, you know, we can't be held responsible for those things as well. But to see God still navigating in those difficult times at the time, it's just a beautiful, beautiful story that sums up, as you said, it's grace. Nothing else. It's grace. And so when you looked at your peers as a young boy growing up then, and then again, I'm not saying boy with disrespect. I'm just trying to go back to when you were that age as a boy. I'm sure you could see some of your peers, what they went through. You were shielded, right, by family and the teachings and the church and all that. What was it like for them?
You know, it's difficult. It's difficult in the sense that, and I'm taking my my eyes back to 35 years ago or so. You know, as kids, kids are just simple, man. And we just enjoy life. We're just friends. We're not connected by level or status or that kind of thing. Yeah. Although, you know, some kids, you know, they were well off, you know. So you kind of group with the people who, you know, don't look down on you type of thing, right? But, and it's very tricky, Tapel, you know. It's a very interesting question. I knew that I wanted better as a young man. I had quite a, I don't want to say an expensive appetite, but an expensive appetite. You know, my dad would take us to Umhlanga Rocks with his old 1978 car. And I would see houses that I've never seen in my life, right? I was like, how do we get there?
Yeah, exactly. That's where I want to be.
But I'm like, it's like TV, you know, the stuff that you see there. And we just drive. My old man didn't have money for ice cream, and he'll take us midweek and on the weekend. It's like in the evening after 6 p.m., he'll take his old car. He was excited about his old car. We'll drive to, he'll take the neighbors, one of the guys from the neighbors, my brother's friend. And we're also, so it's my parents who made us dream of a particular life without telling us to dream. It's exposure. But I don't know what other families went to because, you know, I never peep what neighbors get into. You know, I'm just with my friends in school. We walk on the fence line on top of a fence. We get dusty. We laugh. We do what boys do. But in my heart, there was that desire to do better and maybe advance in life.
That's an interesting, and the reason why I'm asking this question is because, you know, some have argued that there's many things that make young people to see themselves better. And one of those things is a support system at home, right? And some might even say hope, for example. You might be in a very dire situation, poverty-stricken background and all that. But there's always that hope that you have, right, which sometimes can be explained or unexplained. But it seems like when you have that type of support, that type of hope, even your outlook on life seems to become a little bit different. You have this thing that you mentioned, I can do it, you know, we can get there, as opposed to, I suppose, people who don't necessarily have the same luxury. And I know using the word luxury, this seems like I'm exaggerating, but I think that's what you find a lot in the townships where a lot of our young people are born. There's not even a semblance of hope.
And at the center of it, I don't want to say this, and no, my dad is late, and my mom's still alive, and I say to my mom when it's, you know, she's old now, and, you know, when she's busy cooking in the kitchen, I say, you know, Ma, the greatest decision that you ever made was to say yes to my dad. That is the greatest decision. So my mom is retired, and hey, man, for retiree, I mean, She's got a better life than me. Right?
Yeah.
like for real. And I don't know how she got it. My mom, in her mid-60s, she learned how to drive. When she finished her degree in the late 60s, she was retired already. And me and my siblings, we got her a car. And she'll drive the car to church. I look at my mom and I look at my family and I look, what am I saying? I'm saying, the greatest gift, and I want to repeat this, the greatest gift that I believe God gave us was to give us parents who loved their children. And that is central to everything. My dad, I used to be an artist. I'm very creative. We come from a very creative family. My dad used to give us, you know, I'd come to my dad. My dad was, you know, my mom was the one who's like the treasurer of the house. My dad was like the people lover. He was just a carefree guy, so to speak. I'd come with a painting to my dad, and my dad will take that painting and he'll go to my mom. My dad will go to my mom with the painting and he'll say, "Buga, buga, buga, look at what my son has done." So my dad was super proud of the little things. I remember I wrote It was 1990. I wrote an essay in 1990, my primary school. And we entered a competition. I came third in the country.
Sure.
My dad came with a newspaper. And he came, he said, he came to my mom rushing. It was, so now look, think about this. Me as a kid, I'm like, no big deal, right? It's not a big deal.
Exactly.
but the old man was like, in another sphere. So I think what lacked, to be honest with you, our parents didn't tell us what to study. It was a canvas. There was a blank canvas.
Yeah,
they didn't tell us, I want to have a doctor because, you know, I did. They didn't try to live their lives. So if they didn't achieve anything, then thou shalt be because of it. So we didn't have coercion of thoughts. They just accepted us. They loved us. And I think that alone was enough for us to say, let's conquer the world with whatever God has given us. And I think it's the base of everything else.
Ah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. High school, what was it like? I mean, I think if you think about just even the setting of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, I still maintained was not an easy time to be a young man. There's lots of influences, you know, from the political space, economic space. And you have to navigate all of those. What was it like being high school, a young teenager, growing up and discovering yourself?
You know, high school, I was not popular.
Okay.
You know, interesting, this after this interview, I'm going to think a lot deeper about my life. So high school, I was... When I say not popular, I was not famous for anything.
Yes.
I didn't wear Converse. I didn't I didn't afford a pair of All Stars, right? I didn't have Dickies or Collies back then. So I didn't play sport also. Well, not that I didn't. I wasn't big in sport.
Okay.
So in school you're popular if you are good in sport.
Yeah.
Or you are good in academics. So I was like, you know, that guy in the middle, you know, that guy you don't know.
Yeah. that obscure guy at the end of that queue there, that one.
But in high school, so let me tell you a joke. But I was doing sciences, so in high school I did maths, physics, biology, and art, funny enough.
Okay.
Because, they figured I know how to draw, I know how to paint.
Yes.
I was really pushed into that art stream, but, you know, it's working for me today. So with other kids, you looked, well, being in a science class back in that day when everybody was doing home economics and technical drawing and non-science subjects, so to speak, you look like a sellout. like you think you're clever. So that too didn't make me popular, but I think growing up as an Adventist, you get, and I'm gonna say this, it's funny, I don't know now the kids, but we, and I'm talking the old church now.
Yes,
you are always strange. Something's not normal with you. Because you don't do what the mainstream does.
Yeah, true.
And so in high school, when I was not popular, and you know, it was normal in the sense that your friends are your friends. You are not a celebrity of sorts. So, you know, it's like water on top of a duck, right? So it didn't bother me at all.
Yeah.
I didn't have esteem issues because I was kind of used to the uniqueness of my community.
Okay.
And that helped, I suppose, now that I think about it. It helped for me to navigate. And, of course, supported by the love of the parents and the community that I was in.
That's beautiful. Natal Technikon, I mean, the moment I said Natal Technikon, it just said to me, hey, umdala lomntu, we are going very far. Because I said to Natal Technikon. So what was that like, that era in your life? And what are some of the lessons that you think, when you glance back at your time at Natal Technikon, you kind of still use them even today?
You know, coming from high school to a Technikon, it's very funny. I mean, I was lucky. I mean, I got a, thank God, I got a bus.
Yeah.
you come out, and I suppose, what am I saying to a young person today? You come out of high school where there are rules.
Yep.
And, you know, and if you bunk school, there's a record or that's, you know, those sort of things.
Yeah.
You get to a space where there are beautiful young ladies.
Mm.
Right? You can watch movies and just disappear. And
no one will
class.
Say anything.
It's like a kid in a candy store.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And so the first year was tough because I failed a few subjects.
Okay.
And I liked looking good in the first year. By the second year, I dropped the, you know, the fashion and looking good. I could tell that, you know what, at this rate, I'm not going to get very far. I need to concentrate on my studies. What am I saying? I, you know, I look back and I say, and this leads me to something that I want to share with you, Tapelo, and the fellow believers and listeners.
Mm.
I look back now and I look, you know, on that journey, and my program was supposed to be 3 years. I did it in four.
Sure.
Failing humbled me.
Sure.
Because I had to reconcile it with my own ambitions to say the first year was enough for me to get myself back on track. And then I concentrated on my work and what I needed to achieve while I was there. But and I go back, and this is many months later now, to say today, no one. So when I made it to top management in the company that I work for, and no one asked me, can you please show us your senior certificate?
Yo.
No one said, can you show us your undergrad?
Yeah.
Can you show us your exam, what do you call them? Distinctions.
Transcripts, yeah.
Nobody looks for that. At some point, I'm not saying that those building blocks are not important. Primary level. But I want to say this, and we're talking now work and work ethic and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Put in the work. Find the solutions. Ask the questions. At school, I didn't ask questions. I was a consumer. You know, you didn't want to sound like a dumb guy.
Yeah.
Because you just don't want to drag the class.
Yeah.
If you're in a science class, everybody's clever, clearly.
Yeah.
So, but I know that I'm like a D student. I like fun. I don't study much.
Yeah.
So I don't want to drag all the clever guys.
Yeah.
So when you get to a field of work, what changed in my life is post school, when I started to work, and maybe at work, it was a free environment to be inquisitive. And it talks about the guy that in terms of an explorer, an adventurer, a guy who wants to discover. How that helped me in my life and career is, so in my discipline and the things that I do, is that I'm so interested to understand the makeup. How does this thing function?
Yeah.
How does it work? So that I can find solutions. And by default, that makes me an expert in what I do.
Yeah.
Rather than consuming, just once you are cramming school in, you just want to get by.
Yeah.
And so something changed when I went into the field of work.
Yeah.
Definitely.
That's lovely. Talk about the field of work. I mean, you studied also maritime studies, but you work in supply chain as an executive. In my mind, those are two diametrically opposed. How did you even get there now?
So maritime studies as a discipline, you're starting to be a sailor.
Yeah.
Supposed to be a navigating officer. And obviously the highest rank to be a ship captain of a sea-going ship.
Sure, that's definitely the explorer in you right there, going right into the sea.
Well, you're right, but it's a combination of the two. So when I accepted the sponsorship, I said yes to it because, of course, number one, we didn't have money at home.
Yeah.
So they couldn't, you know, my parents couldn't fund me.
Yeah.
But the second part was that I'm going to explore the world. So I thought.
Yes.
And I'm going to get paid in dollars, right?
Yeah.
So that's great, eh? As a young man, money and travel, right?
Definitely.
So I think maritime is about that. But so what happened? I ended up not sailing.
Okay.
And then my dad died around that time when I needed to do my practicals. My life kind of like was disturbed a little bit. Yeah. So I then I did a couple of business courses within the faculty. So I got out of that. So I was employed by a shipping company where I basically became a support service for shipping. So in other words, I was like kind of like a management office of cargo and sea going type of thing.
Yeah.
So that was in Durban, and then I moved to Cape Town. I started operating ships around the world. When I was based in Cape Town, our head office was in Cape Town. Well, that's a different company, trading and around the world. That's what we did, trading around the world. So I had a lot of experience in terms of vessel operations. I had a lot of experience in terms of port operations, where in Cape Town I then moved to port management, managing cargo, storage, port operations, vessel docking, everything that has to do with what you see in the harbors from a cargo perspective. And the reason why I share this with you, Tabelo, and the listeners is how God takes you on what I call a scenic journey. So you don't know the things that you've learned, where they're going to take. In other words, you don't know what going through an art class is going to help you in 20 years' time. You have no idea. Trust the process. Believe in God and just go with the flow and trust Him. Lean not on your own understanding. So for me, as I went through that, then of course I had an opportunity. So the mine called me. So the mine called me up in Limpopo. Over a decade ago. They said, look, we're looking for someone who's gonna run our shipping activities. We are in mine. We are operating road, rail, ports, loading, you know, all those things. So they needed someone with experience from a shipping perspective because it was part of the extension of their support services. So I joined the mine. And long story short, I started to be in charge of the land logistics of the mine. I started to be in charge of the mining activities of the mine, which led me to obviously look to become the executive in charge of from pit to port to market, you know, and those sort of. So now, did I know that I was going to land? Was it my vision? I don't think so.
Okay. That was going to be my next question. In fact, if you think this industry found you, or you found your way through it in a way.
Sorry, come again. I missed that.
I was saying that was going to be my next question to say, in all of that, do you think the industry found you, or this type of work found you, or you found it in a way?
I think God. Just God. You know, and let's go back in the day, mining and petrol. Like if you work for petrochemical companies, you know, the big boys. I suppose as a young man, that's desired in terms of, especially if you have to work for a global company. They're going to expose you to greater things, global practices, some travel, and you know, you're part of a bigger family, not just local. So, but and again, to your question is, I think the mine found me. I mean, I got a call, and I just responded to the call. I mean, I'm like a headhunter. How to find my details is also another story. You know, I don't know. It's some of the things we just don't know. We just and I always say this. God at work.
I love how you, from where I'm sitting right now, listening to your story, I love how you are able to really ascribe even the things that seem like small little things to God, right? And seeing the connection of God and His hand in your life, because I'm hearing that quite a lot in what you're saying. Is that what motivates you?
You know, absolutely. I mean, I think, I think, you know, God is really patient with us, Tabelo. He never tires. And God speaks in a language that you understand individually.
Yeah.
If there are 8 billion of us on planet Earth, God is speaking a different language
to each and every one.
You know, I always say this, and I say, you know, when God was speaking to Samuel, or introducing himself to Samuel, he calls, he interrupts, well, you know the story. Samuel goes to Eli. Samuel wakes up, he goes to Prophet Eli three times, and by the third time, Prophet Eli, who's a man of the cloth, he figures, why am I being interrupted from my sleep? You know, this is God, you know, speaking to. But here's the thing, and I want to share this with you about seeing God's hand. And we must pray and ask for it. Sure. We must pray for God to. And here's this, and this is the storm in the teacup. God. So when God spoke to Samuel, he called him and said, Samuel. Samuel did not doubt the voice. He knew that that voice was Prophet Eli's. He did not doubt. So for three times, Samuel went to Prophet Eli. From, if it was me, I was like, "You, this old man is going to really tell me where to get off because it's interrupting him." But what God did, God used Eli's voice because it was familiar to Samuel. He didn't say, "Sanda called me. Hey, Sanders, where are you, Sanders?" It was clear. And so hence I'm saying, my sheep hear my voice.
So that's beautiful.
A prayer for each one is to say, God, reveal yourself to me. Make me see you in the mist, in the clouds. Let me find you. Give me that distinct sign and voice to hear you speak. And the Lord will reveal himself. And that has been a true truth in my life and that of my family.
I love that. Precisely because I want to ask now one challenge in your career as you know, the time that you've spent, as illustrious as it is. I'm sure there's one challenge you look back at and you're like, yay, this was a challenge. What is that one challenge? And I suppose, how did you navigate it?
There are many, but one.
I know.
There are many, and the one which has been consistent in my life, it's been consistent, has been standing for the right. Yeah, it is tough out there.
Yeah, very tough.
Hey, you are going to burn. I'm not going to lie to you. You're going to burn.
Yeah.
So, as a young man. From my primary level to middle management to top management.
Yeah.
Hey, I mean, if you can see my hands, they are toes there.
Oh, my goodness.
So I say this and I take and I go back and I thank God for my parents to say, never, there are things that you should never sacrifice your values, your principles. You know, Ellen G. White speaks about the greatest want of men.
Yes.
Hey, the world needs men. Good and true men. There is a deficiency of good people out there. And so in corporate, when there is chaos, because there will be chaos.
Yes.
People at a particular time, and God presents that opportunity. It's like that storm of Jonah, it's God's storm. It's God's storm. Understand that is, but you must be able to say it's God at work. You must see it. And at that opportune time, people will be looking for you if you are someone with a spine. If you stand for the right, if you're not caught in skindering and all these shenanigans, and you love people sincerely and earnestly. And it's, you know, theoretically, and you know, you hear this a lot in corporate, people selling themselves for, you know, for the ladder and stepping on other people and all that. I can tell you now that myself, and I'm using myself as an example, and I've said it before, Tapel, is that, it's been scarce. It's just that for whatever reason, I just never gave up. And God sustained me. So that for me has been a consistent story. That has bent my fingers. If you're asking me, would I do it again? Absolutely.
It's who you are. Now, I know you're running out of time. I want us to get into the Cape to Cairo. But before we get into that one, I know it's very exciting. I want to ask you money. How would you characterize your relationship with money?
Money. Mm. So, very, the technical question. Eh? It's tough.
Yeah.
You should have prepared me for that question. So money. Money is a gift. It's an enabler.
Yeah.
I think money is an enabler.
Yeah.
For you to advance certain things in life, and your fellow men.
Yeah.
It's an enabler.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't be saying this, but I wish someone else could say.
But well, there's a message that says, "Answer, Sanda. We are waiting." So people are waiting. We want to know. It's an enabler, and what after that?
it's. Let me put it to this way, and maybe you'll find the answer. I mean, I speak, I tell stories a lot.
So yeah.
Growing up with little teaches you not to expect much.
Okay. Okay.
When you have much,
hey.
You need to understand that much is not permanent.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
And therefore, your relationship with a non-permanent feature, do not treat it as permanent. And I'll leave it at that for now.
That's really powerful. I think that sums it up quite beautifully. But that's really powerful. Don't create a permanent relationship with something that's not permanent. That's
got no control over.
Hey.
You have really no control over it.
Yeah.
So it's not guaranteed. It's like tomorrow.
Sure.
What it is, just accept it as it comes and live your life as it comes and thank God for the blessings. Be able to see the blessings in everything.
Ah, that's beautiful. The message coming in and saying deep. So agree. That's really deep there. You know, Sanda, we grew up with this thing called Cape to Cairo, and it was a euphemism of some sort, you know. And it was a thing that we joked about. Another message coming in and saying you can't control that thing, Yazi. So yeah, I suppose it's difficult to control that thing called money. So listeners,
live within your means. Live within your means. Live. So in English, I'll say live within your means.
Yeah.
Don't and Cape to Cairo. I'm going to answer that. So live within your means and trust me. And trust me, it's a pelo.
Yeah.
That living within your means, it's everything. There's so much joy in that.
Yes,
so much.
That's beautiful. The name of the show is Business Sense. So the comment here says, no matter what they try to tell you on Business Sense, that thing evaporates. So, So no matter how much we try here on the show to just talk about how to manage this thing, it just evaporates somehow. So which is interesting. Cape to Cairo, what a befitting, as young people call it, hashtag there, and what a befitting way to I suppose label near Pigatle Sand.
Yeah, so in September, end of September, we're traveling from Cape Town to Cairo, passing 8 countries over 28 days, 12,000 kilometers in a W123, we call it a car, engineered like no other car on earth. So we'll start with the W123. W123 is a Mercedes-Benz produced, and I'll tell you a little bit of story about it. A Mercedes-Benz produced between 1976 and 1985. So Mercedes produced 2.5 million of those units globally. By 1977, they opened a factory in South Africa, in East London. A production line, not a factory. Mercedes has been here since time immemorial, but they opened the production line to produce this car. So outside of Germany, the first factory to produce this E-Class Mercedes was South Africa. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a story to that. By 1984, I was a church. as a church, and you know, as kids, we kind of like choose cars, right? Like,
especially
this one is mine, this one.
Yeah,
you know. So we're outside of church, Guamasho, and Guamasho is the church, Guachi, Tegachi. So we're standing there as kids, you know, and back in the '80s, there were not a lot of cars. Abazalwane babe struggling back then. Now everybody, Mama,
has a car.
Three cars in one family.
Exactly.
So we see this car. So there's this tall man,
sure,
who comes out and he presses. Now I believe it was an immobilizer.
Yeah.
And the aerial comes from nowhere, you know, like a submarine. The aerial just comes out like, and I was just mesmerized with this thing.
Sure.
Right. I go back home and ask my mom, because clearly Lela Time was doing something that everybody else was not doing.
Yes.
So I asked my mother, you know, that Sunday Eve, which is Saturday night,
yeah.
Asked my mom, she was busy in the kitchen, Ma, Loya Baba, what does he do?
Exactly. Tell me,
what does he do? When's that? Because clearly he's doing what you're not doing.
Yeah.
You know? and others, right? And
yeah.
Al.
Yeah.
So my mother tells me that, so he's a doctor of money. Ooh. Doctor of money.
Okay.
And then I go like, well, I'd like to be a doctor of money
one day. Definitely.
You know, like, as a 6-year-old or whatever kid at that time.
Yeah.
Soon, about, of course, 15 years later. I moved to Cape Town, and I remember the same old man, and I discovered that gentleman was Dr. B.V. Msengana.
Ooh, okay.
So Dr. B.V., he was an economist.
Nazo.
But I didn't become an economist, although I love economists.
So lovely.
So I've always loved that vehicle.
Yeah.
As a young boy, and of course I bought one, and so the Cape to Cairo story, I've been traveling around the world for, you know, as an adventurer. I've been traveling.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of tours on a solo, like a backpacker, Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
I've traveled from Cape Town to Mangochi by public transport.
Ooh.
I also traveled to Kenya by public transport, 7,000 odd kilometers.
Yo.
So Cape to Cairo comes in as a culmination of my passion and that of others who followed the trips, you know, with corporate, you need to, you know, downtime and distress.
Yeah.
So we, last year, about a year ago, the idea was born to take others on this magnificent trip of discovery. When I traveled the east and west of the world, and Africa is just a special place on earth. I tell you, it's just a special place. So we started last year. We did a tour.
Yeah.
We said, let's do trial runs in preparation for the big one. Number one, trial runs. So this is where the corporate part of me came in.
Yeah.
In terms of trialing a product.
Yeah.
So, and again, I go and I say, you have no idea what God sets out for you and the journey that it takes you, and what those skills, when those skills will also come to need in a way. So, we started with trial runs. The first one, we met the Bushmen people in the Kalahari. That was about 3,000 kilometers. Three or 4 months later, last year in June, or sorry, in September, we went. We took a trip from Johannesburg, Eswatini, Mozambique, Pazaruto, Vilanculo, Eastern Zimbabwe, Victoria Falls back. That was about 5,000, 6,000 kilometers. At the third trial run, or the third tour we did, was the recent one that you mentioned earlier on, to Angola. That was about 8,000 kilometers all the way to Luanda, past Botswana, Namibia. All of these, we are training the team in terms of team dynamics.
Yeah.
Remember, people have not traveled, so when they see a man with an AK-47, they're like, oh, Gaffa, so no, he's not a rebel. He's a cop, he's not a rebel.
Yeah.
So that's why we did trial runs, and you are laughing. Oh, trust me, people, when they saw cops, they're like, oh, we must have. Oh, we've been doing all of that in preparation. So we also test the cars. We travel with a chef, we travel with a mechanic. And the most recent one was absolutely rewarding. So the idea is obviously to reach Cairo, eight countries. We've been truly blessed. And how this thing has changed in terms of touching people's hearts, loving yourself. And the whole story is around sharing Africa with the world. What a beautiful people we are. We're not a world food program people. As a South African, I know this very well, that the narrative of Africans is wrong. It's not the right one. The guys that we go with, they thought that everybody's a rebel, they're child, you know, soldiers. It is not true. I'm not saying that there are no pockets of that. I'm not saying that we're not poor. In like South Africa, it's normal. But I'm just saying we need to tell the right story about the vastness and the beauty of Africa, the earth, and what people can do. And the W123 is a good story because 40% of the South African production was South African produced. It was South African sourced. The engine was casted and molded in South Africa. So in many ways, we're taking an African car. So it's not just assembly. It was molded and casted in South Africa, in Atlantis, in Cape Town. So we're talking about artisanry of Africans and what they can do, engineering, art. So it's in many ways, and I want to go back to this scripturally as I go in two seconds. The Bible says, love thy neighbor as yourself. How can you love your neighbor when you don't love yourself? How do we love others when we don't love ourselves as Africans? And for me, it's central to that. When we go out and we, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of a sound mind, of power, and that of love. And as you go there, the energy, and it's like people were hungry for this. We love you, we love each other, and we tell the good stories about how great people are. And that's really what we are on about.
I think you've summed it up quite beautifully. There's a message that says, by the way, Sanda is the reason why I still dream of backpacking across Africa. Used to follow his trip on Facebook, and that was over a decade ago, but at the time I thought one day I will do this. So the day is still coming. So there you go. So quite an inspiration to a lot of people. I want to end it by tying it beautifully in literally 10 seconds because we are already into the next show now. But what would be your way to sum it up, encourage young people as well? As you go on this journey, what are some of the lessons you're hoping to come back with and share? And where can people follow the journey?
So where people can follow the journey, we are on Facebook, Cape to Karo 2024. That's where you can find us today. We'll be putting up our website and all the connections and all of that. And Instagram, where we'll be going live when you do go. But we'll be sharing as we go. We're in the studio at the end of this month, over 3,000 meters above sea level. The last tour will be in the studio before we go. What I would share with the young people today is to say, allow the mistakes to happen and learn from them. Trust the process. It will not matter soon the journey you took. Just follow the process. Be consistent. Never throw the towel. Forget everything that I said. Never throw the towel.
Never throw the towel. Thank you so much, Kuti. Such a beautiful story. And I still think we haven't even scratched the surface of the work that you do and this exciting journey that you are in. We're going to just keep on checking in with you leading up to the day when you depart. So really, really appreciate your time and may God continue to bless you and all the best for the journey.
Thank you. Thank you, Sapelo. Blessings to Seed Media and all the listeners.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Do you want to make your money make sense? Listen to Business Sense every Monday to Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. and make sense of your money.